Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Good evening. This is Marcel Reed. Welcome to this podcast, which is being aired on TS Radio, originally founded by Marty Oakley. Today's podcast, Seeking Truth and Justice, hosted by Lawrence Lucas, will be on in just a moment. But prior to that, we want to acknowledge that this will be the first anniversary of the death of Marty, and there will be a memorial program for her on Monday, April 1st, 7 p.m. Central until 8. If you have an opportunity, we'd love for you to join us in it. Thank you. Hello, Lawrence.
Marcel, how are you doing
Lawrence.
Tonight?
Good.
Hello, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine. Would you like to go ahead and introduce your guest?
Yes. I want to thank you for helping to make this a successful effort, as usual. And I would like to thank and introduce Dr. Frederick Douglass Clark. And I think that has, in itself, has a meaning. Evidently, someone down the road thought that that he was going to be as successful as he is. And I'm pleased to have him on tonight. Dr. Clark, are you there? I want to make sure he's there.
Yes, Dr. Clark is here.
Okay, you there, Dr. Clark?
Yes, can you hear me?
Okay, good. Okay, I just want to make sure you're there. We'll also have a few of our invited friends, as usual, Dr. Wayman Henson and Gary Johnson and C.J. Johnson, who will be taking part in what's going on tonight. I want to say again, thank you, Dr. Clark, for coming on, and I'd like to thank Gary Johnson for introducing us. And one thing that I found very interesting is the fact that you went to Howard University and you went to dental school.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is I'm trying to see what the connection is, and I hope that you'll be able to explain it to us. You will be talking tonight about a very interesting issues, such as related to social justice, poverty, excess in medical care, the possibility of cancer and why it has impact on our community, dialysis, high blood pressure, obesity, and prescription drugs, diet, and poverty, and the absence also of the black leadership in this regard. I want to thank you for coming on again, and I'd like for you to introduce yourself and how you got involved with going from Mississippi when you were 16 years old to now an accomplished dentist. But you are spending a lot of time trying to educate our community. And we would like to take a deep dive into a brief introduction and maybe how you got involved, and then we will follow up with some questions. I also want to let you know that Dr. Wayman Henson and Gary Johnson and C.J. Johnson will be also have the opportunity to ask questions as well. And I think that's very important not to dismiss them in any way. The other thing is we will open up at some point in time to questions coming from our listening audience as well. So you'll get a chance to, and I have no question in my mind that these subjects that we will be covering tonight, we will not be able to cover them in the detail that we want to, because each one is a program in itself. So what I would like for you to do is to kind of give us a touch of what we will be talking about in the very near future and in other programs, both on this show as well as Zoom shows that we will be doing to bring out this participation of yours, at the same time inform our community about things that ordinarily would not be talked about. I want to again thank you very much, and I would appreciate you sharing your introduction and how you got here.
Okay. Thank you, sir. As you stated, my name is Dr. Frederick Douglass Clark. My parents are from Mississippi. And I had the interesting path in life that I was taken to Los Angeles, to South Central Los Angeles in the Compton area, when I was 3 weeks old. And that's where I spent most of my, you know, early years until graduating high school. And then my father sent me to Mississippi, you know, because his family, they wanted to move their family back to Mississippi. So I hadn't had the opportunity to grow up there, but I had opportunity as a teenager to really look at that lifestyle, which I was completely unaccustomed to. I was, you know, raised in an urban area. But in Los Angeles, I was raised in the Nation of Islam, so they gave me one type of perspective. When I got to Mississippi, I was went to HBCU, Tugulu College, and that's a fertile ground for civil rights movement. So I was deeply steeped in the understanding of what the black struggle was really about, especially during the civil rights movement, and you know how we evolved from that point going forward. And then I had the good fortune, as a 19-year-old, to graduate from Tugulu College with a degree in chemistry and biology, and I attended dental school at Howard University College of Dentistry. But as I graduated and left there and got into the dental field, I began to see our community, because I was working in a predominantly African-American community, and I began to see some of the social issues that were affecting African-American people, particularly children, because we had a Medicare program in place that was not serving the needs of the children. People were not able to get even routine dental care and in particular, emergency care for pain, toothaches, abscesses. These were things that simply were not available because Medicaid was a program that was very poorly structured. And I think the whole thing, when we look at social justice, is that African-American people as a whole were just being, you know, neglected when it came to health care. I think that problem really, we didn't really see a real impetus to change that until President Obama became president and then the Affordable Care Act passed, and that allowed access to care to become more accessible to a lot of people. Excuse me. But along that way, I had many opportunities to be involved in legislative action, sitting on committees with the state of Maryland to help to bring forth a viable Medicaid program for children. I sit on committees to try to bring about access to care in terms of adult dentistry, which in the state of Maryland, that only came to pass January 1, 2023. But one of the things about being an African-American community, and we talk about health disparities, and when we speak of that term, we're speaking of those things that disproportionately affect us, like the problems of obesity and diabetes, heart disease, a stroke, prostate cancer, kidney disease, liver disease, you name it. We have been afflicted by these conditions for a lot of years, for a long period of time, unaddressed. And there's no access to, it was not good access to care. If you didn't have job-related coverage, then you couldn't really get, you know, good access to care. If you were say, below the poverty line, or you did not, or you were working poor, that type of thing. So I had an opportunity to see a lot of patients come to me, and we saw advanced stages of diabetes, advanced stages of heart disease. People have, you know, problems with obesity, having, you know, respiratory problems, all kinds of problems. So it made me more aware of what was going on with our community. But within my own family, I had the misfortune to be diagnosed with diabetes at age 20. And I've, since that time, gone through a large number of medical conditions that could have, you know, killed me, could have taken me out years ago. But it forced me as a healthcare professional to begin to look at what were the issues that were affecting me directly, but it also allowed me to look at the African-American community and see how what I was going through, that my people around me were going through the exact same things, but I was blessed with that education and knowledge in the medical field to be able to be to say, well, how can I, you know, develop my learning process around these things, see how I can help our people a lot better. And that's what I've you know, sought to do and lend a voice to. You know, how can we do a better job of helping our people to learn how to recognize disease, what needs to be done about it, you know, what are the problems, what brings them about, and how can we manage. And, you know, this healthcare system has not done a good job of helping us with that. So that's how I got to the space where I am now. Hello. Hello.
Hello, I'm here. Dr. Clark, this
yes?
is Marcel. I wanted uh-huh. to ask you a question, and I just figured out that our paths have crossed. I'm also
oh.
from Compton and surrounding areas.
Oh, wow.
yeah, okay. This is a very small world. And,
yes,
and
it is.
I would, yes, and I'd like to ask you a question, though it may be a little offline here.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing that this same group of illnesses are crossing the country with us, no matter where we are. We see
mm-hmm.
the same cluster of illnesses, diabetes
mm-hmm.
and high blood pressure and heart disease, and these clusters
mm-hmm.
seem to be everywhere. I wanted to talk about this in regards to both guardianship and to talk about how it affects our economy across the board. You know, farmers
mm-hmm.
lose their farms when they become incapacitated.
Mm-hmm.
People
yes.
Go into guardianship and can't get out because of
mm-hmm.
the same cluster of diseases.
Right.
And I had particularly focused on something called dialysis because I was
mm-hmm.
working with some people in that arena. And
okay.
I was amazed at what was happening to people because they had kidney failure. I was just
right.
amazed. Yeah.
Okay.
So I know everyone has a question for you. I just wanted to talk about that because I was on the Hill last month lobbying with dialysis patients, and
mm-hmm.
the rates at which they are dying is just unbelievable to me. Someone I was rallying with died 11 days after we were on the Hill and
mm-hmm.
from dialysis. So
right.
I wondered if you might spend a moment
I
talking
still will.
About that. Yes.
Okay. My mother and my brother both died from kidney disease and dialysis-related illness. The statistic is that most people, 80% of people die from heart disease after they are diagnosed with kidney failure and end up on dialysis. Usually the life expectancy is about 5 years. I have been living with chronic kidney disease now for about 20 years. And fortunately, I've been able to hold it at bay. But let me say this, first and foremost, that most of the people you see on dialysis are over 40 years old. And I bring that up for the reason that most of the problems related to the vast majority of people, not all, but the vast majority of people who have diabetes usually have, I mean, who have a kidney disease or kidney failure and end up on dialysis, usually they precede that by having obesity and diabetes, either or both. So what we have to do is we have to look at, okay, how do we go from, say, age 40 where we may not have these medical conditions that may lead to death or kidney-related disease and, you know, complications. And there is a direct line of how that occurs and how it can be prevented. But we don't get at, you know, what we call early detection and treatment and the causes of kidney disease. We usually find that the persons who end up on dialysis are treated as if this is a condition that came about from itself, but they don't say, okay, what caused it? And that the usual cause is usually diabetes. So if you talk about, if you can actually put them those hand in hand, then most of the people who are on dialysis, most of them have diabetes first. So you understand what I'm saying? So when you see them, when you see people who are undergoing dialysis at that time, they're at an end stage treatment of life, unfortunately. And that's why, and usually it's not a reversible condition. It is not something that most people live a long time with once they are on dialysis. And it is, it's really traumatic because most people have to do 3 days a week of dialysis, 4 hours a day on a kidney dialysis machine. And so it's just debilitating. And, you know, those people also, a lot of them experience a lot of other problems, vascular problems, problems related to stroke and heart disease. So it's a cascade of things that occur once you get in a slippery slope of diabetes and then you advance to your kidney failure.
Thank you, doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight, my name is Wayman Henson. I'm a semi-retired psychologist, family therapist living in North Texas. And my work and interest in these areas has several different prongs to it. One is that in terms of working within the African-American community, going back to 1994, I think it was when I began to work with black farmers. And so I began to observe all of the things that you're talking about, strokes, kidney disease, diabetes, hypertension, sexual disorders, on and on and on. And then I would begin to look at what were those diseases caused, or were those diseases causative? And so I began to look at a thing called intergenerational trauma or historical trauma. And that whole area of research and science has come a long way since that particular window of time. And what I'd be curious to know from your expertise and your experiences is how is it and why is it that the literature about African-American farmers, the literature about American Indians is so replete with the idea that unresolved historical trauma leads to epigenetic processes so that these bad things are going to be cascading down upon them. In a personal sense, I was diagnosed with renal cell carcinoma in 2019. And then at the same time as that, I was diagnosed with small cell lymphocytic lymphoma. And with the way my wife had taken care of our medical insurance, this and the other, retirement, we got to choose our doctors and all this other kind of business, and healthcare is really outstanding. But what I noticed when my wife and I would drive to various clinics at the University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas, I noticed that white people were the predominant group of people. And I asked a friend of mine one day at church, What happens to our African-American friends, our Black American friends, if they have cancer, if they have leukemia, what's going to happen to them? And our nursing friend just simply said, they're going to die. And so with good medical care and good insurance, I'm alive and kicking and doing well. So I'm a white guy and have not experienced multi-generational trauma in the way that American Indians have or Black farmers have. But I also noted coming out of that that the health disparities were absolutely incredible. And so that whole area has become an area of much interest and much concern. So could you respond to that web of curiosities there and how trauma is a multi-generational thing, and if it's not addressed, then it's going to get you through some physical malady or the other. Is that too many questions, Dr. Clark? Can I give me to shape it a little bit for you?
No, we're fine. When you talk about epigenetics, you talk about those multi-generational traumas that occur. Well, you identify what are those traumas. Are those traumas physical traumas? Are they psychological traumas? Are they traumas because of poverty? Are they traumas because of the fact that you can't get the health care, you live in a community where jobs are scarce? I will say this. If we were to look at the root cause of most disease, the root cause of most disease turns out to be malnutrition, and the malnutrition is brought on by the poverty. Okay? So if your diet is not adequate to give you optimal health, and the reason that you don't get optimal health and you don't get a good diet, and you don't understand what a good diet is, you don't have access to healthy food and healthy air and healthy environment, living conditions. If you are surrounded by an environment where there are vermin and there's mold growth where you live, and there's, you know, roofs that have holes in them, all these type of things that poverty brings with it, it's going to exacerbate those problems related to disease. So that means that if you're not getting a good diet, if you're malnourished, and when I say malnourished, because people usually assume that I eat enough food, that's not nourishment. Because you can eat a large quantity of food that makes you feel full and still be totally malnourished because you're not getting all the vitamins and minerals and macronutrients and micronutrients and, you know, enzymes and proteins and those type of things in your body that you need to be optimally healthy. So we look at other populations, those people who have access to all these accoutrements of life that make life livable, make you healthy and whatnot. Those people don't suffer the same degree of health disparities as those people who don't have. I think that when we talk about multi-generational trauma, we have to go all the way back to when Black people were first brought here as slaves. Mm-hmm. We have to go back to when the Latino populations had to fight with the white Americans in this country who forced them off of their lands with war and whatnot, with the American Indians, people who had to deal with how this country came about. Well, so we're talking about multi-generational trauma to a whole bunch of different groups of people in this country. But when we look at how it is manifest today, we're still dealing with the problem of the wealth gap between African Americans and the white population. We're still dealing with the fact that health care was not something that was available until the Affordable Care Act, say, we're going to see if we can address this. We're going to see if we can bring about some parity in health access to care. And even though you may put more money into it and people have more access, now we find that you know, the number of people who are trying to enter the system for care, they're running into a roadblock because there's not enough people to give the amount of care that's necessary. So we look at diabetes or heart disease. We see that the numbers are staggering. Kidney disease and dialysis, these are staggering numbers now because for so long they have not addressed at all.
Right.
So now all
right.
of a sudden we're looking at, say, well, how can we address these things? Well, one, the first thing we need to address is say, okay, we have to get to people before they get to that point of disease where your body begins to break down because of malnourishment, because of lack of, you know, good nutritious food, because of the propensity to, that poor people have to eat foods that are highly processed foods, a lot of sugar, a lot of foods that contain GMOs, a lot of foods that contain mm-hmm. seed oils and things that cause metabolic disease and metabolic destruction. So when you look at obesity, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, all of these are metabolic-related diseases because of the food intake, because of the type of food that you're putting into your body. And I use the word food loosely when I say food, because we're talking about food. We're talking about either whole foods, or we're talking about foods that are processed and manufactured. And when you divide those and you say, okay, these people who eat whole foods typically are much healthier than those people who eat processed foods, or people who go to fast food restaurants, and that's their primary food form of eating. People who feed their children Cheetos in the morning because that's what's available.
Right.
Where they have food deserts, where there's not food available in the community. People don't have access to new cars and stuff. They can't drive somewhere and get good food. So what they'll do, they go to that local store down the corner that sells only, say, convenience food. So you get all the donuts and cookies and cakes and, you know, hot dogs and all that type of stuff you get, but you're not getting anything that's healthy. Those foods are toxic and poison. They create inflammation in the body. They're toxic and poison, whereas whole foods are healing.
Right, right.
So food is the primary reason. Believe that food is the primary reason that all of these medical conditions exist, the type
right.
of food that you put in your body.
Let me ask.
Did I touch on anything?
Yes, yes, you did. You, for me, you raised a lot of questions, and I envision this conversation as a bunch of folks sitting around a round table with a bunch of microphones in front of us with kind of easy give and take. And so I really appreciate what you're saying, because it really does scratch the itch of what I feel about that one of the greatest contributions to wealth for white America is the houses that we live in. And the greatest problem for Black America is the houses that they live in, because that generational wealth is not going to grow, because the Veterans Administration, World War I, World War II, made mm-hmm. sure that our Black soldiers did not get treated with the same benefits that our white
exactly.
soldiers did. But that's a long, drawn-out story. But let me ask you one more question. Supposing that the Black farmers that I'm talking about had good houses, ate good food, that they grew a lot of the crops that they were eating and that sort of thing. And suppose that I were to say that I would be inclined to say that nutrition was maybe a problem, but not the problem within. And what if I were to come along and say, what if I were to say, Dr. Clark, that stress in terms of macroaggressions, racist systems, and then number two, the plethora of microaggressions literally wore the farmer and the spouse and the family out. Would you say, Henson, you're on to something? Or would you say, nah?
I would say that they go hand in hand.
Okay.
I would say that, first of all, if we bring up Black farmers, people who live in rural settings, nowadays, they're getting their food from Walmart and grocery store. They're no longer growing their own food.
Very
so they
few
having
are.
The same,
right.
Like they're having the same problems of diet and nutrition that you have in urban areas now. Now, if you talk about 50 years ago, when we had more of an agrarian society, you had more of a society where some people were subsistence farmers. They grew their own food. They were able to eat the food that they grew. They grew. They had healthy foods. But now that we have to, most of us across this entire country, have to get our food from agribusiness. Our foods are shipped across the country unless you have, you know, the co-ops and the small farms that have locally grown fruits and vegetables, but that's not where most people get their food from. And farmers also eat prepackaged, highly processed, highly palatable, unhealthy, metabolic destroying foods. Everybody eats the same thing now.
Sure.
So if you're a farmer and you're sitting and you're watching TV, you're still going to see the same commercials about the Cheetos and the crackers and the potato chips and the fast food restaurant. You're still going to go to the McDonald's. Even if you've got to drive 50 miles to get there, you're going to eat the same things. So the farmers are not immune because they're farmers.
Okay. So then how would you factor in the notion of intense stress?
I would factor that part in because, see, when we look at the fact that the health issues that are exacerbated by the fact that the food is not good, stress on top of that causes, you know, the breakdown of the body in and of itself. Hypertension is a result of stress. Obesity has a lot of relation to stress. Cortisol release is released in your body that contributes to microvascular disease that can lead to strokes. So, yes, the same condition, the same problem that all black people are afflicted by because of the condition that they live in, the black farmer, he has the same problem, but it's even made worse because if he's in a situation where his livelihood depends on whether or not he can get those funds to run his farm when there's a bad season, can he get the money to recoup his crops? Can he buy new farm equipment? You know, all that is extremely stressful. It's more stressful than somebody losing a job because, you know, now your family's tied into it. It's not just you. So, yeah.
One of the most painful situations that I ran across back in 97 or whenever it was, I was in the state of Louisiana and I was there to interview three or four different generations of this family. I didn't get to see Mr. and Mrs. Farmer until the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But when I did get to meet them, he walked in walking with a limp, with a cane. The left side of his face was drooping. Mm-hmm. He slurred when he spoke, and he sat there with a handkerchief wiping up his drool the entire time that I talked with him. He had had a stroke maybe 6 months before. The fancy language was he'd had a cerebrovascular accident. And then when I met her in the very same occasion, I was really stunned. Petite, almost pixie-ish, the way she looked, hair done up in beautiful cornrows.
Mm-hmm.
But it only took about 2 minutes of attempting to have a conversation with her, and I realized this woman is not all there. Mm-hmm. And to make a long story short, their narrative, was staying up night after night after night after night, paranoid that they're going to come and take the land and kick them off of it. So she had developed a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia and was medicated with the medications that you and I would know about. So the stress of having their farm taken away sends them down the path of a stroke and sends her down the path of psychosis. And that was when I thought, I've got to join forces with these people and help them to get their cases settled.
Right. And that was the problem of the black farmers trying to get the monies that would due them, the lawsuits that took place. A lot of farmers were not even able to participate in getting those funds to them to this day.
Right.
And it's a tragedy. So I know what you're talking about. As far as in my practice, I see lots of brothers, a lot of black men who come in there who have had a stroke and they're 50 years old.
Yeah.
But see,
yeah.
One of the bigger problems is this. When you say hypertension and you give a person hypertension medication, And then you go to see the doctor every 6 months, every year, and they tell you, oh, your blood pressure is controlled. No one's saying to them, how do you reverse the blood pressure problem in the first place? And that's what the problem is, because you have the stroke because the blood pressure was never managed.
Mm-hmm.
So even because
it can spike. It can spike in the face of one intense microaggression.
Exactly.
It can stroke out with the notion of, yeah, we have money, but we don't have any money for you.
Right. Exactly.
Or we don't have money for, we have money, but we don't have money for you people.
Right. Well, see, if you look at, if we're talking about money, if we had simply had, after slavery, been given 40 acres and a mule.
Somebody felt that,
you know, we should get reparations for what our lives have been in this country.
Mm.
A lot of us probably, we wouldn't find ourselves today dealing with the same thing we've been dealing with for 400 years.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's the microaggression. That's the generational traumas that we talk about. We've never been made whole, and then we're in a system that has not given us health care, has not given us access to good food, has not given us education, has not prioritized us as a people. And that's where these micro traumas come from.
Right. And it sets up the whole dynamic, I think, where African Americans or American Indians are not going to trust the physician unless the physician looks like them. And so how many Indian doctors or how many black doctors do you see? Not many.
Well, if you talk about the number of black doctors in relation to the number of black patients, there's always going to be a disparity. And most doctors are going to practice in cities as opposed to small towns and rural areas because they can't make an income otherwise. And as I say to everybody, I say the primary way that an African-American doctor usually makes a living is by subsidized care. You have to see Medicare and Medicaid if you're going to address the needs of your people.
True.
So, yeah, so it goes from top to bottom that if you're in the African-American population, that unless you're blind, unless you're putting blinders on, you see what the problems are clearly. You may not talk about them, but I talk about them.
Yep. Well, thanks for responding to my wonderments about those things. I appreciate it very much.
Yes, sir. Hello.
Hello. Is there anyone else that has a question for Dr. Clark? If not, I have an observation, Dr. Clark, since we're talking about people who are Compton and South Central. Are you familiar with Dr. Joy DeGruy and her entire...
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yes,
I follow her a lot, too. And she addresses all of the questions that Dr. Henson was just speaking about. And I think that's really important because I know this is the Black Farmers, this program focuses primarily on Black farmers, and I know this is something that Lawrence is very passionate about. But we also have a program called Medical Slavery, which is hosted by a nephrologist. And he brings this up very often about how it holds us back in every area of life if our health is less than perfect. Yeah,
right.
And it does. It really does
hold us
back. So just a moment. Let me see if Lawrence has anything he'd like to say at this point. I'm sure he does. Lawrence?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello? Can you hear
me? Yes, Lawrence. Yes.
Okay, some kind of way my phones went on to blink, so I've been kind of absent and trying to get it straight for the last few minutes. Yes, I do have a question for Dr. Clark, and I'd like to thank Wayman and you all for continuing while I was trying to straighten out my phones here. I would like to know, out of all the issues that our community is facing, what one or two issues you feel as though is the worst, if not the one or two areas that we need to be concentrating on and get some leadership from those who are responsible for looking out for our community. So I'm asking two questions. What is the list of one or two things that we should be focusing on, and who should we be putting pressure on to make sure those illnesses are addressed in our community to make sure that we are as healthy as the white community? Dr. Clark.
Well, sir, black leadership to me is a archaic term. We've been fragmented along the lines of leadership. I think the only person that we can say who's tried to maintain the realms, the leadership role, say Louis Farrakhan, or I did likely listen to what's the gentleman at Georgetown University. I'm going to remember his name in a minute, but we don't have any. We don't have any coalescence of individuals who are saying, you know what, this is what we need to be doing as a group of people to help ourselves along the lines of education or health care, or you name it. We're too fragmented as opposed to finding common ground to have leadership to look at our problems. We do have a lot of individuals, but we don't have anybody at the top anymore. You see, you don't have a Dr. King or a Jesse Jackson or anybody of that nature of stature who has the respect of the black community to address these things. So I know there are a lot of individuals out there who are trying their best to say, you know, these are problems in our local communities, but what we're doing as far as a national effort on the parts of African-American people in terms of improving healthcare outcomes, there is no central, as far as I know, a central point of work that is being done to address our issues.
Okay. That said, what is the difference between, based on your experience, because I wanted to find out what are the one or two illnesses that you think is ravaging our community the most. Can you just answer that in a few words?
Yeah, I think if you talk about diabetes and heart disease, I would have to say that those are probably the two that are preventable, But see, as long as we're not serious about life, first of all, because we live our lives as if we're on autopilot. So even when someone says to you, these are unhealthy things to eat, and we don't understand that food's purpose is to nourish you and make you healthy. If you don't eat the foods that nourish you and make you healthy, then we can't go to the next step and say, well, why do we have all these health conditions? These health conditions are directly related to what you put in your mouth. So if I tell you that you should not be drinking a 22-ounce soda or a big gulp or something like that because of the quantity of sugar that's in it. I tell people all the time, I say the human body utilizes sugar called glucose. Glucose is about one teaspoon in the bloodstream at any given time. But the minute that you drink a large soda, you might be consuming anywhere from 22 to 30 teaspoons of sugar. Your body cannot handle that amount of sugar. What it does is cause a great influx of insulin in your body and shoots this sugar all to the liver. Now the liver has to try to figure out how are we going to process the sugar. And what it does, it converts it to fat. After you've done this so many times, you've triggered this insulin release so many times, the pancreas stops functioning to the extent that it can handle all this excess sugar, and now you become diabetic, and now you get the cascade of things. When you have diabetes, you have what we call metabolic disease. And usually when you get diagnosed with diabetes, you get what we call a triad of diseases. You get diabetes or high blood sugar, you get hypertension, and you get high blood fats or high cholesterol. So they automatically put you, to manage you, on three drugs. They put you on drugs to bring your blood sugar down, either metformin or insulin. They put you on drugs to bring your blood pressure down. And they give you drugs to bring down your triglycerides and raise your HDL and lower your LDL. But at the same time, all that sugar coming to the bloodstream causes you to get what we call fatty liver. You used to never see fatty liver in people unless you saw they were alcoholic. Now they have what we call non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. This is even common in children. If you have this going on, you also have the cascade effect of failure of the pancreas and failure of the kidneys, failure of the vascular system, and failure of the heart. They are a cascade. So the best thing we could do is recognize food, how we consume it, what we're consuming, how to prevent diabetes, and how to prevent hypertension. Hypertension, yes, is affected by a lot of different things, but food has a great effect on it.
Okay. Thank you so very much. There's another question that I have, and then we're going to go to our listening audience. What is the life expectancy, or why is life expectancy in the black community different than the white? Can you kind of just give us a quick, from your viewpoint, why is that?
Because as a group of people, we are less inclined to seek medical care. We have a tendency to live on autopilot. We believe that we know when we're sick. And in fact, you hear black people say all the time, I know, my body tells me when I'm sick. And I tell people all the time, there's no way you can know what's going on in your body without getting some type of blood test done. Check your biomarkers, see whether or not your blood glucose, cholesterol, if your chemistry is correct, you have deficiencies of vitamins or nutrients or whatnot. There's no way for you to know what's going wrong. I tell people all the time, I say, if you have a need for anywhere from 60 to 90 different nutrients that are supposed to be replenishing your body every 24 hours, and you don't replenish them, even if they are needed in microscopic amounts, like your micronutrients, like your magnesium, your manganese, your selenium, your copper, your zinc. If you don't have these things, they cause your system, your metabolic system, to bog down, to slow down. So as you get older, the more that you do that, the earlier you die. In other words, if you have a car, you're supposed to put fuel in it every week. The minute you stop putting fuel in it, it's going to die. It's going to stop running. And that's what happened to your body.
Okay.
So you have to do it from the time you're a child to the time you're 99 years old. You have to do the same thing. You have to put in all those nutrients that the body needs. But most of us do not know the nutrients that we need. And we're convinced that if we eat a proper diet, we're fine. But no one has defined what a proper diet is.
Okay. Thank you. I think you've kind of answered my question, but before we go into the question and answers, maybe questions from the audience, C.J. Johnson, are you there tonight? You joined us, and I'd like to know if you're there. Do you have a question for Dr. Clark?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, awesome. Thanks for having me on. I guess my only question would be, what would you think would be the solutions for some of these disparities and some of the healthcare outcomes, especially for the African-American community? As we've already kind of touched on the healthcare system, we touched on some of the nutritional issues, things like food deserts and lack of nutritional options in a lot of different areas, and the lack of national leadership. So with that lack of national leadership, what should the strategy for us be to try to improve these material situations for our community?
Well, the first thing we have to do is understand what the word unity is. And you know, that talk about African-American people, there was a time we used to talk about things like black unity. We used to talk about, economics amongst black people. We working, to do business amongst black people, to coalesce around helping each other. That's the first thing we don't do. We don't help each other. So sometimes, and what we do, I hate to say this, but when we're 40 and beyond, and 40 and younger, we live in a haphazard manner. We don't understand how to put together things to get our housing in straight, get our credit straight. We don't understand this country's capitalism. We don't understand this country's rules to engage in to be successful. And because of that, what we do, we get a job. We get an apartment. We buy a car. We spend frivolously. We take vacations. We go to the club. We smoke weed. We smoke alcohol. Cigarettes. We drink liquor. We do damage to our bodies. And we don't come together collectively, mentally, to work on things of an intellectual nature to help ourselves. See, if we don't bring our brains to the table to work together, then all these other things we're talking about are moot. We have to bring our brains to the table and say, where is the black intelligentsia that's going to say, you know what, we are failing here, 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 here. What are our solutions? So I always say this. Each generation that comes along has the responsibility to step up and say, you know what, we have to do what is necessary, just like they did in the 60s and Civil Rights Movement. The black populations should be doing the exact same thing. I was telling Mr. Lucas the other day, I said, my generation really dropped the ball. My generation acted as if things had worked out for us, that everything was fine. We abdicated our leadership. So now our young people don't even listen to us when we try to guide them as mentors. We don't have black mentorship teaching our young people how they should act. We don't know how our women should be acting. They're out of control.
But we just have another call on 205, and I just wanted to get them in, and we are 8 minutes out from the program ending.
Okay.
So let me check and see who's on 205 and if they have a question. Hello, 205, do you have a question for Dr. Clark?
Yes.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, please ask your question.
I have a question. Hello?
Yes, ask your question, please.
Yes. I would like to know why the doctors in these days do not tell the black people to go to herbs. You know, there are many of the herbs on the black farmers' lands that they could use for many of these diseases, such as high blood pressure, kidney disease, liver disease. One or two that come to mind is like goldenrod, using several of the herbs that just grow natural around your house, like arrowroot or mullein, or using dandelion. Those type of herbs are very good in a tea that will aid and assist people with high blood pressure. It will also aid them in the system in the cholesterol. It will cleanse their liver. It will cleanse their kidneys. And the doctors never tell you about those type of herbs. And the reason I say so is because I'm Queen Mother Bernie Thatcher. And the reason I'm talking about them is because I'm 85 years of age. And on my farm, I always pick the green herbs when they first come up before we mow the yards or before we started doing anything else, because you don't want any type of chemical to be on them. And I always tell people, pick clean. Pick the herbs clean. Dry them naturally and put them in a sterilized jar and use them as a tea. And this can also aid and assist because many of these herbs also have a diuretic type of component in it that will also help wash out some of the additives that we have in our bodies.
Yeah. Okay, Ms. Atkinson, that is a good question. I'd like, because we only have about 6 minutes left, I would like for Dr. Clark to respond to your question. Dr. Clark.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So is Alabama, is it 205 Alabama?
Is
205 Alabama?
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe it is.
Yes,
so,
yes, that's Alabama.
If you come from a culture where you understand herbs. See, the medical community was never based upon teaching people about the utilization of herbs. We, as a people, have used herbs for medicinal purposes for years and years and years. But when we talk about the standard of care that doctors are held to, herbs have never been anything, has never been something that people have said, okay, we've tested it. We know what it does. We know what its toxicity may be, and we know what its utilization may be. And because of that, if you, as a doctor, tell a patient you use something that you have not studied, you might be putting yourself in trouble with the medical community. The medical community has guidelines that you have to follow. So you can't just step out and say, you know what, I'm holistic. I think that you should use this, 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 and this. You can't do that. They don't allow it. You will lose your license and your livelihood. So I don't say that the herbs don't help. There, God made the herbs for us as medicine for our body to heal us. No question about it. But they were not ever made a part of the U.S. healthcare medical system.
Wow! Thank you very much, Marcel. I want to kind of thank Dr. Clark for coming on because we only have a few more minutes left. But Dr. Clark, I want to thank you for coming on tonight. But most importantly, I would like for you to join us in this struggle to educate and help us in seeking justice as well as truth of many different issues. And I want to thank you for coming on, but I want you to come on again and possibly again during this year to share with our listening public and our, especially our urban, but especially our rural communities that need to know about what you have as solutions to deal with this very serious health problem. And I know that you can do a great deal with the education and bringing a different focus to our programming in terms of caring for those people who do not have a voice. And we and our group and what we are trying to do is open up the airways to make sure dialogue and information such as what you have to give us and share with our listening public around the country, because people are listening on this show all around the country, including Australia and other countries around the U.S. Marcel, is there anything you want to add before we close? But Dr. Clark, we're going to give you the last word. We got about two more minutes, real short. Give us what you think where we need to go and how you can help us.
Okay, I appreciate you having me on this evening. I would love to, you know, come on in the future. I think that I hope that what I've said this evening has been, you know, contributory to your efforts, and I think that our people need a lot of help. I think there's not enough voices out there that are being directed at making certain that we have the correct, the proper information, the access to information, and credible source information, because we get a lot of misinformation which misleads us. And a lot of what we're looking at in terms of the disease, a lot of it is reversible, a lot of it is preventable. And that's what I want to contribute to the conversation.
Thank you very much. Marcel, do you have anything to add before we close?
Yes. Thank you very much, Dr. Clark, and thank everyone who has appeared on the podcast tonight. I want to let you know again that the platform for this podcast, Seeking Truth and Justice, has been TS Radio, founded by Marty Oakley. This Monday, April 1st, will be an anniversary program for Marty that will run from 7 Central to 8 Central, which is 8 to 9 Eastern. I hope you'll be able to join us. This is a great woman. She started this network. We're carrying it on in her honor, and she has always platformed Lawrence's program. Until next month, Seeking Truth and Justice with Lawrence Lucas. Do you have any last words, Lawrence, before we end tonight's program?
I just want to thank all for participating tonight and especially having the opportunity to have Dr. Clark join us and, in fact, join us again in the very near future. Thank you very much, and good night.
Good night.